This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to See How They Run, horse race coverage from the left, brought to you by The Nation. I'm Dee Dee Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. This past Tuesday, Jamal Bowman, one of the most prominent progressive politicians in the country, was defeated in the primary for his New York congressional seat. The election in CD16 laid bare many of the issues currently dividing Democrats. The battle between the establishment and the left, the role of money in politics, and most bitterly, the party's stance on Israel and Gaza. So what does Bowman's defeat tell us about the Democratic Party, particularly its left? And how should we think about the role of the Israel lobby, whose campaign against Bowman turned this race into the most expensive House primary in American history? Today on See How They Run, we're joined by two people who spent more time thinking about these issues than almost anyone I know. Later in the show, I'll be speaking to Peter Beinart, editor-at-large of Jewish Currents, former editor of The New Republic, and one of our leading voices on the relationship between Israel, Palestine, and U.S. politics. But first, we turn to Mika Sifri, writer, organizer, author of the Connector newsletter, Election Maven, and most importantly, a former Nation editor who lives in Jamal Bowman's congressional district. Mika, welcome to See How They Run. Jamal Bowman went into this race as a second-term incumbent. Normally, second-term incumbents just sail through. And my question is, we've heard about AIPAC's multi-million-dollar donation to his opponent, but how much of Bowman's difficulty was of his own making?
Well, first of all, it's great to be here, and it always feels like coming home to do something with The Nation after spending a good chunk of my early years there. So I have to say, I have known Jamal personally since the night he launched his campaign in 2019, when he was an unknown. He was a middle school principal from the Bronx, taking on a 30-year-plus powerful Democratic incumbent, Elliot Engel, who I had suffered under as my representative in Congress already then for almost a decade. He had the goal to try and challenge someone like that, believing in the power of young people especially Black and brown young people, to propel him forward. And indeed, the room was filled with former students of his who were literally in love with him and raving about him, and it was infectious. And I thought, if he can bring this energy to this race, he has a chance. Though when I asked him, how do you think you're going to win? He said, well, we're going to register all these new voters, like the kids here. And I said, well, honestly, that's a really hard way to beat an incumbent Democrat in a primary. You might be smarter to figure out how to get a lot of the regular voters to switch to you, because they might be ready for a change. After all, this was a majority minority district represented by an aging Jewish white guy
who was
for a very long time.
Who was AIPAC's most reliable vote in Congress and chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. So
at that point, he was finally had made it to chair. That's how Jamal won. He didn't so much build a new force as he shifted a lot of people in his direction. He was helped by the surge that happened. This is, the spring of the worst of COVID, when Engel was not even living in the district, got caught, kind of flat-footed. And a lot of the grassroots energy that had gone into Bernie Sanders' campaign and the Sunrise Movement showed up with people, you know, on Zooms phone banking for Bowman. I think we made more than 2 million phone calls.
Well, I can also attest to that, because in the spring of 2020, Waleed Shaheed, whom I'd met running a Bernie Sanders office in South Philadelphia in 2016, asked me if he could bring in this guy, Jamal Bowman, to the nation. And I said, well, there's no bringing in. We're remote, but the staff would love to meet him. So he came to a staff meeting, and he did not have, you know, adoring former students. It was just him, but he totally won us over. He was charming, passionate, committed, intelligent, charismatic, you know. And given that getting rid of Engel seemed like a pretty good idea, regardless of who was running against him, this seemed like a great gift.
Yes, and everything broke his way. There was another black candidate in the race who was convinced to drop out, that cleared the field, that made it a two-way race. George Floyd's murder happened a few weeks before the primary, and I think there was a surge of not just black activism, but also white guilt, and an openness to you know, a changing of the guard, if you will, and a sense that it was time to share power more equitably. And I think that was really what propelled him to victory. But I would say that 2 years later, when he ran for re-election, and only got about 54% of the vote in a three-way race.
That was in the primary, yeah.
In the primary. In this district, everything's decided in the primary. It's a very blue district. The two candidates who ran against him, one who was kind of recruited by Elliot Engel to run, and another who was a local town committee woman who thinks she belongs in Congress, they split the anti-Bowman vote. But between them, they got 44-45% of the vote. And that was a signal that there was some weakness here that he should have tried to address. But I would say that the deep story here for me is that Jamal, I think, number one, just was not good at local politics. It was not interested in learning how to be good. But also, I think, got pulled by the national progressive organizations who are looking hungry, really, for champions like him, rhetorical champions, people who will, you know, with a very loud and passionate voice, speak out on the national stage or in Congress. He was getting adulation from them at the same time that he was not doing the kind of base building work that you have to do in order to maintain your political viability back home.
Well, so can you give some examples of the, you know, I mean, I've always thought that the Tip O'Neill remark about all politics being local was idiotic, but it's certainly true that you can't stay in Congress if you don't maintain your base. So what was it? What were the marks of inattention to that?
The first one is, let's face it, the first primary that happens is called the money primary. And every member of Congress and every potential challenger is looking at one thing. How much money does this person have in the bank?
Right.
And in and what I've heard from insiders is that Jamal just hated to do call time. He really did not want to put the hours in that every member of Congress, if you're not famous or rich, you just have to dial for dollars. It is the worst part of the job. And in the summer of 2023, this is before he has pulled the fire alarm.
Right.
This is before October 7th leads to a complete rupture on the liberal left, both nationally and in the district. He had his summer filing with the FEC at the end of the second quarter showed that he had only $180,000 in the bank. And this is a blinking green light to someone like George Latimer. Because if Jamal had done what any savvy political operator does, which is you build up your bank account so that by the time somebody's thinking of maybe challenging you, the first thing they look at is, oh, wow, he's already got $1 million, $1.5 million in the bank. It's going to take me a while to catch up. And instead, what this showed was weakness. And indeed, when Latimer got in, Latimer waited. I mean, he was being wooed by the Jewish community. There were a group of rabbis closely connected to AIPAC who were begging him to come in. This is after October 7th, but it had already started before then. But when Latimer got in the last month before the end of the year, he outraised Jamal. I need to go back and look up the numbers, but I am sure that he brought in more money than Jamal did. He had more money in the bank by the end of the year. And that, I'm convinced, is what showed AIPAC that there was blood in the water. So that's example one. Example two, Don, is he talked about power building and organizing, and he didn't do it. I was invited to attend an event last summer that he did with the Black Male Voter Task Force of the DNC. And he invited Black men from Yonkers, which is next door to where I live, to a meeting, a lunch and a meeting to talk about their issues and to talk about organizing. I was the only white person in the room. I felt very welcome there. It was a great meeting. And at one point he even said, if just all the Black men in Yonkers were registered to vote and voted, we could have picked the next mayor, which is true, because the mayor of Yonkers, it's basically, he's a political boss. He's got 20 members of his family on the payroll, and he won his primary with like 5,000 votes. So it's absolutely true that an organizing effort in Yonkers could tip the power there. There was zero follow-up from that meeting. The next time I got an invitation following on that meeting was 4 days before the primary. And right. I went, and none of the people who had been at that meeting showed up. So you can't be all hat and no cattle. I don't know what the Bronx version of that metaphor would be. but the thing is, I mean, Jamal is passionate and inspiring to many people. But most of his volunteers in this race were not from the district.
I know. I went to the rally on Saturday, and I saw mm-hmm. these young women in Jews for Jamal shirts, and I wanted one, but I also wanted to know who they were. They were all from Boston.
Yes, I know. If not now, and by the way, lovely people. Some of them are my friends. But you know, this is an old problem that we progressives have even pointed out to mainstream Democrats, which is you don't win elections by parachuting volunteers in from out of state, you know, in the last 2 months before an election. This is not how you build power. And voters can sense it. They can sense when they are, you know, it's like a transactional thing. We need your vote. Well, why should I give you my vote? This is where, of course, his opponent excelled in exactly the kind of, it's not just retail politics, it's showing up at Little League games and soccer games and the sorts of things where you're just seen as part of the community.
Well, okay, so that's one narrative, and I think it's an important one, which is you have somebody who wanted to be a national politician but who wasn't paying attention to the local context.
Right.
But one of the things that fascinated me in the last issue of your newsletter was the change in the local context, and particularly the kind of sociological roots of the difference between Westchester and the Bronx. So I have two questions there. One is, let's talk a little bit about that, because my sense is that, and you'll tell me whether this is wrong, my sense is that there's a way in which this primary was lost during redistricting, that when when he lost so many Bronx voters and gained so many Westchester voters, that was what changed. That kind of pulled the rug out from under him. Am I wrong about that?
No, that's not correct.
Okay.
I'll tell you why. First of all, it's true that the district he ran and won initially in 2020 included more of the Bronx, but it included a big part of the Bronx that was not friendly to him at all, which is Riverdale and Kingsbridge, the northwest corner of the Bronx. It also included Co-op City, which has always been sort of a fairly middle-class black and brown community, a wonderful place, by the way. He also lost that, but he gained a little bit of, kept the central part of the Bronx. But look, he held the seat in 2022, even though it had been changed. But he was relieved to lose Riverdale. It's true that he won Riverdale in 2020, but very quickly there's a big Jewish community there that's quite conservative, and they were also grumbling about him and not at all unhappy, I'm sure, to now have AIPAC's best friend Richie Torres as their representative. The district that I've seen this going around now, that he lost, it was foreordained because he went from having a 60% Westchester district to a 90% Westchester district. That's not correct. In 2020, it was already 90% Westchester. In 2024, there was one more redistricting that was done last fall. And this is the one thing that Hakeem Jeffries reportedly did to help Bowman, was he ensured that they gave him back Co-op City.
Yes, I saw the photo of Jamal in front of the Co-op City sign after the redistricting was announced.
Right. He was very happy.
Yeah,
he was happy that he had that back, and in fact, he won Co-op City overwhelmingly in this primary. Sociologically, I mean, there's a different point. Perhaps I should just let you ask your question.
No. Well, say a little bit about, as it were, what made historically Scarsdale? In other words, there are some historical factors that I thought were fascinating that I had no idea about until I read your post. So
yeah, well, the thing about Scarsdale, I mean, in a different universe, this race would not have been so much about Israel and Gaza and AIPAC and genocide and so on, and it might have instead turned on, what version of the future we want for the people who live here. Westchester has historically been a very segregated suburb, and that goes back to the days of redlining and restrictive covenants in people's real estate contracts. I know that's an issue that Jamal cares about and wants to do something about, and that, in fact, County Executive Latimer has a record of slow walking the process of desegregation and defending what's called exclusionary zoning, which is the system that basically says, you can't build a house unless it's at least on an acre or 2 acres, which means it's only for rich people.
Right.
Right. When Kathy Hochul, our governor, tried to push through a statewide change that would have mandated more dense housing near train, where all the commuter trains stop, all the suburban towns fought against that. And Latimer was a big ally in helping to kill that. As he put it, we like our little towns with our little village streets. And, the implicit we there was obviously we white people.
And we pretty well-off white people.
We well-off people. I mean, there's also well-off Asian people right here, and there are well-off Black and Hispanic people here as well. That issue barely surfaced in this race.
In a way, that brings me to, the $64,000 question. This is a district that before October 7th, polling had Bowman down by 10 points. Is that wrong?
Mm-hmm. I never saw any reliable polling, you know, that wasn't done by a group with a partisan stake until very late. So I don't know if we had any polling that you can really cite. There is this one DMFI poll, which is Mark Mehlman, who was, you know, in sort of the AIPAC camp,
right,
that came out in the winter that showed Bowman down by about 17, which in the end seems to be the margin. So maybe it was an accurate poll. You know, the Working Families Party did a poll in the district and leaked that it was supposedly neck and neck. This is the same poll that supposedly showed that 2/3 of the district favored a ceasefire. But again, the people who really cared most about the Middle East, you know, in terms of voting on that issue, were two communities in the district. One, a very politically powerful and well-organized Jewish community, and a much smaller Muslim community, which also, you know, which Bowman's team did a very good job of engaging and cultivating and you know, to their credit. But, you know, the estimate is that there were maybe 30 synagogues that were part of this supposedly nonpartisan effort to get out the Jewish vote, where the turnout in those synagogues ranged between 60 and 90% of all their adult members.
Okay, so that, in a way, that goes a long way to answering the question I was going to ask next, which is how salient was Israel and Gaza in this race? I'm looking at the numbers, and the margin in the end was less than 15,000 votes.
Right. In the end, it was, you know, like any primary, relatively low turnout. A lot of people do not pay attention to primaries. I went to Co-op City before things really ramped up, and I walked around talking to people if they were even planning to vote. Most people didn't know there was a primary coming up, or most people say, well, I only vote in the presidential in the fall.
Right.
Right. So, you know, you have to, nation readers are not like this.
Well, God bless them.
But, you know, the average person is just not paying that much attention. And to the degree that they heard about the race, this is where the AIPAC money was important, is that they flooded the airwaves. They flooded digital. You couldn't watch a YouTube video if you lived in the district without first seeing 30 seconds that were either praising George Latimer or attacking Jamal. And almost all of those attack ads didn't talk about Israel. They talked about that he didn't support Biden because he didn't vote for the infrastructure bill. And that's one of these places where progressives were too smart by half. You know, you'd have to sit people down and explain to them why there was this strategy to hold out for the other half,
of,
you know,
build back better
bill. And that what Jamal did in the end by voting no, first of all, he had permission from Nancy Pelosi to do it. And secondly, it kept the pressure on Joe Manchin, and eventually Manchin caved in later with the Inflation Reduction Act. So maybe you could say that he actually helped get all these wonderful things to happen in the inflation. By now, people have eyes have glazed over. They have no idea what you're talking about. All they're hearing is he didn't vote for it. Why didn't he vote for it? All the other Democrats voted for it. And I can't tell you how often that was a stopper for people. I suspect in many cases, who are not paying attention to the Middle East that closely. You know, the intensity of the argument between the pro-Palestine and the pro-Israel sides, which is happening here in this district like everywhere else, is a big turnoff to people who do not have that much investment in it. You know, the polling suggests that maybe 20% of Americans are really paying attention to Gaza.
Right.
And the rest are kind of like recalling. And I have friends who are hardcore activists, for example, in Indivisible locally.
Right.
Which has been a very important force for grassroots, get out the vote, organizing up and down the ballot, who are not Jewish and who are not Muslim and who don't really feel like they understand the issue that well. And all they could see was that their friends were fighting with each other. And they would withdraw. It was a downer. It was a something that sucked energy from people instead of making them more motivated to vote. Well, but the Jewish community, hyper-motivated to vote him out. clearly. And that's the other thing about Westchester that is important for progressives to understand. We do not have significant progressive Jewish organization here. The groups that, like the people you met from Boston, If Not Now, Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, Jewish Voice for Peace, they're all very marginal here. There isn't a single out progressive rabbi in terms of Palestine.
Right.
I mean, I do know the at least one rabbi who did vote for Bowman. That's because they asked me for advice. And I can tell you right now that Jamal Bowman does not know this person's name.
Right. So I guess there's a sub question to that, which is, it sounds like Israel-Palestine was still fairly salient.
But not in a way that helped him as much as it hurt him.
Right. But then what about the money? How salient was the AIPAC money, or would the result have been pretty much the same without those $14
million? Well, one of the things that people need to remember is that AIPAC is not just national, it's also local in Westchester. One of the former presidents of AIPAC lives in Westchester, for example, used to be the president of his synagogue here. Many of the rabbis and congregants go every year to AIPAC's big national convention. They've been doing deep community organizing around the country for decades. And J Street, which is a group I have been active with, which is more liberal, it's meant to be an alternative to AIPAC. It's pro-democracy, unlike AIPAC, which endorsed lots of election deniers just because they're pro-Israel. But J Street has a tiny foothold by comparison. And Jamal actually lost J Street's support by getting too outspoken and too sloppy in his advocacy for Palestine in ways that it just became impossible to defend.
Well, I have to say, as somebody who watched this from a distance but has great admiration for Bowman as a person, it sounds like he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't. I mean, you know, remember, October 7th, he comes out, he condemns Hamas, he condemns the violence, and then, and even before then, he goes to Israel on a fact-finding trip sponsored, I believe, by J Street.
Correct.
And votes for Iron Dome and then gets hauled up before DSA and threatened with expulsion.
Yeah.
How much did that put a target on his back?
Well, I think what the story is deeper than that, which is that I think there was a pathway open to him in 2020 where he actually, upon winning the nomination, he wrote an open letter to the Jewish community after getting some heat, saying that he was looking forward to being a bridge builder and looking to learn together and to become better acquainted and then proceeded, I think, to run, first of all, into a degree of flack, a degree of distrust. The organized Jewish community is hypervigilant. And, you know, some of his earliest moves he made without consulting. I mean, I know this for a fact, that people were kind of blindsided, that some of his early legislative, you know, decisions to co-sponsor a bill by Betty McCollum that was about ensuring that no U.S. aid could go towards imprisoning or torturing Palestinian children. I mean, it's an admirable bill to support. It's going nowhere. But he didn't do any advance work to sort of say to the friendlier rabbis in the community, hey, I'm signing on to this. I want to let you know, you know, I realize it may ruffle your feathers a little bit. None of that. You know, there's a way to build trust and overcome distrust. And instead, I think he got caught in a dynamic where ultimately he just decided it didn't matter what he tried to do. But I still will come back to the potential. This is not a right-wing you know, it's a heavily blue district, which is majority minority, and with some real effort at organizing, it could elect a progressive. We do not have to have someone to the right of Joe Biden in the form of George Latimer, who says he doesn't want to raise taxes on wealthy people. You know, he doesn't want to have a big climate bill with his name on it. You know, he's acting incredibly modest. I think it could support somebody better than that. But I do think that Jamal got way out ahead on his skis and stopped trying and also kept making unforced errors. You know, he gave a speech where he did say that he didn't believe the reports that women were raped on October 7th. And I cannot tell you how many liberal white women, whether they were Jewish or not Jewish, would bring that up as a stopping point for their ability to consider voting for him. And yeah, he recanted it by saying that the UN report showed that there was evidence of sexual violence. And of course, he's against all forms of sexual violence. But it wasn't until a week before the election that he actually said, "I apologize." At which point, forget it. People's minds have been closed.
Right.
So I think we you know, it, what's very rough here right now is the temptation is to say that the only lesson from this debacle is that right-wing billionaires have now learned that they can buy seats in Congress and they're going to take on more progressive Democrats in these kinds of primaries. And I don't think that is at all the right lesson.
So what is,
I think it's
what is the right lesson?
To me, the lesson is that building progressive power does not have shortcuts. being a social media influencer and a star on NBC does not guarantee you your ongoing viability as an elected member of Congress. That it still always comes back home to ensuring that you have a base that will support you when you want to go out and do courageous things. And the I refuse the number of people who volunteered, poured untold hours of blood, sweat, and tears into trying to help him hold the seat were not helped by this kind of malpractice. And this adulation of the squad, and even worse now, the way that the non-electoral half of the pro-Palestine left is behaving, which is it is imposing these kinds of language purity tests on people to the point that some of them were even outside protesting. You went to the rally. You saw some of those people from the Within Our Lifetime group condemning AOC and Bernie Sanders, their only allies in Congress who are have any standing to criticize Israel quite toughly and not fear the repercussions. And they're shouting at them that they're standing with Genocide Joe. It's insane. Well, and it's time to say that it's insane and that it's not helping. It is not helping because it is only reinforcing the right wing in Israel. And it is helping drive a important piece of the Democratic coalition to the right here in the United States.
I hear you, and I did see them at the rally, and I was dismayed to see what a large portion of the numbers they made up. I would say probably 10% of the people at that rally later were marching around and chanting and saying, you know, chanting against Bowman at his own rally. Are there specific strategic lessons for the left that we should draw from this?
Well, I think the left has to wrestle hard with how much the conflict in the Middle East has turned into a kind of black hole that is pulling people into a situation where it becomes hard to unite around common interests, and it's dividing more than it is bringing people together. And I think, you know, AOC did something very interesting a few weeks ago, a conversation about anti-Semitism and democracy, which was very much about how to navigate the need to be able to express tough criticism of Israel for its policies without necessarily delegitimizing people who have a connection to Israel. And that she was trying to square that circle. It's a very, very hard thing to do, given the pressure right now to perform your angst or outrage.
Or your loyalty. Netanyahu. I mean, yeah.
Well, both. Yeah. I mean, I know, but I think the expectation right now on the left is to perform a kind of, outrage at genocide. I put that word in quotes because I think it's being inappropriately used. But it's a kind of moral performance that's become expected. And I think that strategically this is not helping. I think the other one goes to the harder issue of how we organize power when so much of our attention and money gets sucked into the high profile spectacle of elections, which means at the last minute people donate, at the last minute people volunteer, and that base building is something you have to do year round. The weakness demonstrated by Bowman was partly something that he contributed to, okay? But he was also enabled by other organizations that kept telling him he was great while they themselves weren't doing very much organizing either. We are stretched.
Well, that did strike me on Saturday. I thought, where are our troops?
You know, there aren't.
He had his troops, but where are our troops? And they weren't there. They really weren't there.
There aren't. Well, since COVID, you know, this is the hard thing we have to admit to ourselves, is that there's been an exhaustion. You know, there was an incredible intensity after Trump was first elected, and millions of people got active. And then between pushing Trump out in 2020 and COVID, I think a lot of people went back into the woodwork. They were not sustained in the work. This is hard. And we also have developed a type of politics that is both a lot of drudge work. We ask people to do things that are hard and boring. Make phone calls, text message, knock on doors. None of that is that much fun. And the other thing we ask people to do is meet purity tests that make a good part of the left seem like a bunch of cranky scolds. That instead of welcoming people who aren't perfectly aligned with us, we find all of the reasons why this one and that one isn't just right.
That's also a rich topic, which is why is the right better at popular front politics than the left? But maybe for another day.
Another day. But that's the strategic point to me, is this could have gone differently had we been doing a different kind of organizing year round. Certainly that had to be led by the congressman and his allies. And I do think we got overextended. I think there is a vibrant capital S or small s socialist left in New York City. And they definitely had a big part in helping Bowman win in 2020, but they didn't follow him into the suburbs in any significant way. And sooner or later, you know, things were going to come back to their normal, quote unquote, you know, the normal power structure, as I put it in my last piece, the empire strikes back.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what happened here.
All right. Well, Micha, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and always a pleasure to read what you have to say. So I look forward to doing more of both in the future. Thanks again.
Thanks, Don. It's wonderful to see you too.
It's my great pleasure to welcome Peter Beinart, editor-at-large of Jewish Currents, editor of the Beinart Notebook, which you can find on Substack, and one of our leading voices on the relationship between Israel, Palestine, and U.S. politics. And I should note that while this goes out on a Saturday, we are taping on a Thursday, so there's no worry for those of you who are monitoring Peter's compliance with the laws of halakha. All right, Peter, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
So there's a lot to discuss in this race, and I want to start by asking the obvious question in a way, which is, how much was Jamal Bowman the author of his own misfortune?
I think mostly not, but there probably was some element of that. I think the two single biggest reasons he lost was, first, that he was redistricted into a district that had more of Westchester and less of his political base, which are Black and Hispanic people in the Bronx. And secondly, because there was just an ungodly, unprecedented amount of money, a stunning amount of money poured into the race against him by AIPAC and other pro-Israel groups that had also recruited a fairly strong challenger, George Latimer, because Latimer was very well known in the district. I do think where people have critiqued Bowman is on things like not voting for the infrastructure bill, which was kind of one of the things that was used to attack him. A statement after October 7th, where he initially questioned whether there had been sexual assault, although by Hamas fighters, although he did apologize for that, and perhaps a more general kind of lack of coalition building and constituent service that he did. But I think without the redistricting and without all of that money, even those deficiencies would not have cost him his seat.
Well, I think that's a perfectly reasonable position, although I'm going to push at it a little bit, in part because our previous guest, Mika Sifri, disagreed on both counts.
And yes, so
I want to give you a chance to answer Mika's view, which is that in terms of redistricting, it's true that Bowman lost some sections of the Bronx, but he also lost bits of West. But one of the sections of the Bronx he lost, Riverdale, was the section that would not have done him any favors in this race. And also that he had been substantially redistricted before 2022, and yet he won in 2022. In other words, the terrain was, in theory, no more difficult or not much more difficult now than then. So what do you say to that?
Yes, and I should say Mika lives in the district, and he's more, I would say, intimately familiar with the local realities than I am. I would just say, and so I think we're talking about a question of degree here. I'm not suggesting that, again, that Bowman didn't do anything to make his position weaker. But as I understand, it's through Riverdale, which is a Jewish and a significantly Orthodox population, was one that was not favorable to Bowman. But the new district has areas in Westchester that are also quite Jewish communities that have strong Orthodox communities that lean politically to the right, maybe even a little more to the right in some of those Jewish communities in Westchester. And I think that when you compare him to the last time, what happened the last time was that AIPAC wasn't able to recruit as strong a challenger, and therefore AIPAC and the other groups didn't put in as much money. So it was a more favorable circumstance for Bowman, but in part what happened was that AIPAC was just more effective this time in getting their guy, and then once they felt they smelled blood in the water, they went in unprecedented ways.
Right. Well, I guess that's the other question, and here I think you are perhaps uniquely qualified to address this as a veteran and diligent AIPAC watcher, which is this the case that it was AIPAC that did it, as they would say in British tabloid headlines, or is this the case that AIPAC put in a ton of money, which allowed them to rush and take credit for something that was probably going to happen anyway?
I think that the way AIPAC thinks about it, I think, and also other pro-Israel organizations, because other people have kind of joined this party besides AIPAC, Democrats, Democratic Majority for Israel and other groups, is they don't want to lose. Right? They don't want to put in a lot of money if they think they're going to lose. So they put money in where they think there is some vulnerability, but then they dramatically increase the vulnerability of the person they're attacking because they put in the money, right? So there's a bit of a chicken and egg. So I think that, yes, Bowman was a weaker incumbent than, let's say, Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar or AOC, or even perhaps Summer Lee, partly because of the nature of the district, because he is probably more progressive than his district on Israel-Palestine and on other things. And they were able to get a strong challenger who had very deep roots in the district politically.
I don't mean to slow you down, but I think it's worth rehearsing for our listeners how they got this challenger. In other words, what is the process that produced George Latimer challenging Jamal Bowman?
Well, I think what, again, I was not in these rooms, but I think based on the reporting I've seen, what happens is that people in the district know that that someone like George Latimer understands very well that if he enters this race, he will have tremendous resources at his disposal, right? So therefore, if you're a politician, it can change your calculus on whether you want to enter the race at all, because you know all of a sudden your chances of winning have gone way up.
Right. But I mean, in other words, it sounded like AIPAC was looking for somebody to challenge Bowman even in 2022.
Yes, I think right. I mean, they has been a major target for them ever since he beat Elliot Engel. The whole reason that AIPAC, which is now operating in a different way than it used to, it didn't used to have a super PAC. It didn't used to directly give money to candidates. It used to basically work through these other organizations. The whole reason I think that AIPAC changed its model to go to super PACs, where they could now raise unlimited amounts of money from like people who write million-dollar checks, was the threat from the Squad. And Jamal Bowman had become a member of the Squad. I think what AIPAC was afraid of was a kind of contagion effect, where people saw that that AOC could survive, and Rashida Tlaib could survive, and Ilhan Omar and Jamal Bowman, and all these people could survive. And then it emboldened other progressives, because let's be honest, most progressives, given if they look at this situation of what's happening on the ground, will not be inclined to a position of unconditional support for Israel. It's just radically contrary to basic progressive principles. So they had to reestablish in a very strong way this deterrent that you don't want to be Jamal Bowman. And so that would staunch the bleeding. And so this group of Squad members who have these sympathetic views on Palestinian rights, that it would not expand. And they have been, unfortunately, somewhat successful in that.
Well, I guess, yes, in the sense that Bowman lost.
Yes.
But, you know, does this loss mean that AIPAC is now what it wants to be, which is the 800-pound gorilla that nobody dares cross? Or is this loss, in fact, evidence of that AIPAC is losing the argument, so they've taken Jamal Bowman and given him a punishment beating for the same reason that, you know, nobody pays protection money to the mob because they love the mob. They do it out of fear.
Yes. But then again, if you're the person who has to pay that protection money for the mob, or else you get years and years, you get kneecapped, it's pretty cold comfort, right? That they feel like that they have to do it. I think clearly what's different about the Israel-Palestine dynamic today from 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago, and you know, you've been following this a long time, is public discourse in the media, in the public culture, has shifted. Right. It used to be that there were a lot of prestigious, very respectable, high profile people in public discourse who were liberals or even progressives in good standing who were very staunch defenders of Israel. That is much less the case today. Right. Just look at my old magazine, The New Republic. Right. Which was a very prominent, not left-wing magazine, but considered a liberal publication, influential in Washington, very staunchly pro-Israel. It is not anymore, and there is no equivalent of that old New Republic today in American public discourse. So in a way, and you can obviously on college campuses, you can see this even more dramatically. So what happens is you have to then intervene, because you're not successfully intervening in the public discourse. You have to intervene much more aggressively at the level of finance, right, to insulate the Democrats in Washington from this shift in public culture. In a way, you could say a version of this is happening on universities too, right? Because public discourse at the universities is shifting a lot among students and faculty. So how do you insulate and make sure that these universities don't ever divest from Israel, for instance? You intervene at the level of money with donors, right? And so yes, in a sense, this is a form of weakness, but in a society as plutocratic as ours, where money plays such a profound role in our politics and in other institutions, it's still a very effective card for it to play, whether it's being played by AIPAC or whether it's being played by, you know, Bill Ackman at Harvard.
Right. No, I mean, if you live in an oligarchy, the oligarchs still have power. They have a lot of power.
Right. Right.
And you know, which in a sense begs a question, because Bowman had a great slogan: "They have the money, we have the many."
Right.
Except that he didn't have the many. So what do we do about that?
Look, this is a problem. I mean, first of all, again, money has a huge influence, especially in these kind of house races. It's not like a presidential race where everyone knows who Biden and Trump is, right? So you're not going to basically probably radically change their view about these guys because they know who they are. But in a house race where many people didn't know who George Latimer was very well, and maybe not even didn't know that much about Jamal Bowman, this volume of money can have a really big impact. Secondly, the challenge for people who care about Palestinian freedom, as you and I do, is that even if progressives are moving in that direction, and Democrats as a whole are moving in that direction, as they clearly are, according to the poll, it doesn't mean that it's their top issue. Right? It is still an issue that is fairly remote from their ordinary lives. It's not the equivalent of the Iraq War, where you had to worry your own kid could be sent overseas. So you could have a situation where someone agreed with Jamal Bowman, but you could turn them against him because of, let's say, advertising about his vote on the infrastructure bill, which might seem more immediate to people, right? So this is part of the problem, is that even if progressives are with Democrats, progressives support Palestinian rights, do they grant it the salience that mean that they are going to vote for people on this issue? And conversely, a lot of Democrats can afford to disagree with their constituents on this issue because it's not one of the top voting issues.
So that's a terrific observation, but it then prompts a whole host of questions. We published a piece yesterday by Waleed Shaheed drawing, mm-hmm. you know, the lessons he thought that the Palestinian movement should draw from Bowman's defeat. Yeah. And one of them is that we have to organize a mass movement about this. Now, you know, Waleed and I don't always agree. And I suppose on this question, I'm not sure I do agree, because while that's certainly something you can do in some districts, it's something that's never going to win a congressional election in Westchester. So how does those people who care passionately about equality and justice in Israel-Palestine, how do we proceed tactically within and outside of the Democratic Party?
Yeah, I mean, look, it may be that this is just a fight, a struggle that takes years and decades. And that's very painful given the horror that's happening on the ground that the United States is enabling in so many ways. But it may just be that because of the, this is not like the anti-apartheid movement where you didn't have such strong forces on the other side. What you had on the other side of the anti-apartheid movement were people who cared about the Cold War. They didn't want communists running South Africa. But the anti-apartheid movement had the great good fortune that as they were gaining steam in the mid-1980s, Mikhail Gorbachev came to power. The Cold War started to fade, and then in some ways it became even easier for them to start getting U.S. sanctions. We have something here which is a much, much more formidable adversary and is not going to go away anytime soon. But I think sometimes if you look at movements, you can see that they, you know, there's the famous line, there's the long march through the institutions, right? It takes time, right? So if we think about, again, I'm not saying that this is the analogy of the anti-war movement, but if we think about the anti-war movement in 68, when they got, when they couldn't even beat Hubert Humphrey, and then 72, when they could nominate George McGovern, but he lost 49 states, those were pretty depressing. But in the 74 midterm elections, the Democrats elected the Congress that cut off aid to Vietnam. So I think that what may happen in the best case scenario, and again, if you look at Occupy in 2011, I don't think many people would have predicted that 5 years after Occupy, you would have Bernie Sanders. But in retrospect, you can see the way that Bernie Sanders was taking the energy of Occupy into the political movement. So do we have a candidate, let's say, in 2028, assuming we can still have elections in America in 2028, in a Democratic primary, who we may not even be thinking of, who comes into this moment and picks up that energy and basically can run with it. Or in some other places, I think that's the best case scenario. We're still clearly years away from that.
So in the meantime, what is the role of activists on this issue vis-a-vis the Democratic Party? What do you worry about? What do you think we need to pay attention to in terms of this issue in November? You know, what is the lesson of the Bowman defeat for the Democratic Party in November?
Well, I think that in a way, there's not. I worry that progressives will be even more dispirited, and it will be even harder to get them to vote for Joe Biden in the fall because there's already so much understandable, like profound alienation from him, and that we could have Donald Trump. And I think one of the many dangers of Donald Trump is that he would make pro-Palestine organizing harder, right? That the environment will become more repressive than it has today. I think over the longer term, it's still progressives who care about Palestinian rights still have a big problem in raising money. There are a lot of very big donors on the right who prioritize this issue. There are not a lot of big donors on the left who prioritize this issue. They may be donors on the left who have more progressive instincts, but they don't care about it in the single-minded way that someone like Miriam Adelson or Bernie
or Chaim Sabin.
Or Chaim Sabin, right? And this is true even in the Jewish community, as you know, which is to say there are plenty of Jews on the left who basically, you know, have at least moderately pro-Palestinian views. Some of them have a lot of money. But
their kids turn out in Jews for Justice for Palestine demonstrations.
Yes, but the irony is that the very universalism that leads them to care somewhat about Palestinians also leads them to not only care about this issue, right? So they're distributing their money across. They're also concerned about reproductive rights and about the climate and a whole series of issues. And whereas someone like, you know, Miriam Adelson, who really couldn't care less about any of that stuff, right, is focusing all of their money on this. And that creates this disparity. If you had a national candidate, a la Bernie Sanders, who captured people's imaginations, they could potentially take a pro-Palestinian view and raise a lot of money online from small donors. You know, this is something that Joe Biden couldn't do and hasn't tried to do. And it's very difficult to do at the level of a House race, unless you're really a national celebrity, maybe like a Rashida Tlaib or an AOC. But I think it may be possible in a Democratic primary race. Not this year, of course, but in the future.
Right, right. I think we may cut this into a different place in the conversation.
Sure.
Because
sure.
I probably should have asked you this earlier, which is, could you tell us a little bit about AIPAC, its origins, its evolution over time, and how it came to be this single-minded machine, and, you know, also the progress or the transformation of a group that used to be mostly giving money to Democrats and is now giving money to dozens of election-denying Republicans?
Sure. So AIPAC has been around, goes back into, you know, its history goes back into the middle of the 20th century, but it wasn't really a dominant organization until the 1980s. The reason that it became so influential in the early 1980s was that the kind of legacy influential Jewish organizations like the American Jewish Committee, the American Jewish Congress, which existed then, and the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, as it was imagined then, those were organizations that had, by the 70s, they were doing pro-Israel advocacy work by the 1970s, after the 67 war, but they also had a fairly liberal domestic agenda. And it became clear once Reagan won that their liberal domestic agenda was a problem for being a pro-Israel advocacy organization, because it meant that they didn't have a lot of influence with Republicans. What turned out to be AIPAC's key source of influence, what made it the preeminent organization, was that once conservative Republicans had taken over in the 1980s, AIPAC, because it takes no position on anything that happens in the United States, it does not care about what happens inside the United States, it could therefore be ambidextrous ideologically and bipartisan. And so that's what essentially made AIPAC so influential starting in the 80s, was that it could work with Republicans. And its position, its role has always been to cultivate donors who have relationships with members of Congress, ideally in their districts. But if there are not enough rich Jews in their districts, they can hook a senator from Oklahoma up with a Jewish guy from Manhattan. And those individual donors raise money for those members of Congress over decades and develop strong personal relationships with them. And it's those donors, not the AIPAC staff, but those donors who give AIPAC its real muscle. The problem with, the moral problem, putting aside the moral problem of AIPAC's position that it will support the Israeli government no matter what Israel does, the other moral problem, which has been exposed in the Trump era, is that because AIPAC's model is, we are a single issue organization and we judge you only on whether you support unconditionally Israel, that once the Republican Party becomes a grave threat to the future of democracy in the United States, AIPAC does not care. In fact, it's not only that it doesn't care, it's that because it sees everything only through the prism of unconditional support for Israel, it's actually more sympathetic to those people, because the people who want to create a white Christian authoritarian America, on average, are more unconditionally supportive of Israel than the Democrats. And so that's why AIPAC is supporting all of these Trumpist election deniers.
So, given this evolution, and given the fact that as the leading edge of the Israel lobby, AIPAC has only grown in strength and influence in the last 8, 10, 12 years, how should we think about it, and what can we do about it, and what can we do about it without falling into the easy traps of, knee-jerk socialism of fools, anti-Semitism.
Right. So look, I think it's not that hard to talk about the influence of pro-Israel big money in the United States in the way you would talk about the Koch brothers or the pharmaceutical industry or any other lobby, right? You should just talk about it the same way you would talk about this corruption in general. And I think most of the time, I think the vast majority of the time, that is the way people talk about it, right? Occasionally, people might use get into language that suggests kind of cabals, that shadowy conspiracy theories or whatever. But that's most of the time. I actually think people don't speak that way, but of course, people accuse them of basically playing into anti-Semitic stereotypes. But the people, frankly, who are playing into anti-Semitic stereotypes are AIPAC. Right. I mean, it is kind of ridiculous to say that you are basically that a pro-Israel, largely Jewish organization is going to spend huge amounts of money. And then you accuse the people who talk about it as fueling anti-Semitism. It exists. Right. It's like, was it anti-Semitic to talk about Bernie Madoff? The guy was a Jewish crook. Was he not allowed to talk about it because he was a Jewish crook? The problem was with Bernie Madoff. He shouldn't have been a Jewish crook, right? AIPAC should not be a pro-Israel organization that is undermining American democracy in order to support an apartheid state. That's their fault, right? So I think in terms of how to respond to it, what I hope will happen is that people will, in the Democratic Party who have influence and money and other resources, will recognize that if they want to defend American democracy, they also have to fight against AIPAC. They can't say, well, I don't care about the Palestinians. I mean, that's an immoral position to take anyway, but it's also a really stupid position to take if you care about American democracy, because Israel, through its demand for unconditional U.S. support for Israel, is actually threatening American democracy by supporting all of these election deniers.
So aside from the long campaign to make AIPAC as toxic as it deserves to be, which, you and I are both fully engaged in, what can we do to protect allies like Cori Bush or AOC, and not just members of the squad, but, ordinary progressives who, because they don't toe the line on Israel-Palestine, whether they go as far as some, pro-Palestinian progressives would like or not, have drawn a target on their backs that AIPAC is aiming at. How do we organize to defend them?
I think what I would like to see that a range of different groups that may not entirely agree on every question having from Israel Palestine, whether it's from Justice Democrats to Working Families Party to J Street to Jewish Voice for Peace to Arab and Muslim groups, could basically come together around defending these folks. And I think the other point is, as I said, is we have to make the case to people in the Democratic Party that when Jamal Bowman loses to George Latimer, it's not only a defeat for Palestinian rights, it's a defeat for all the other things you care about. Because the people who fight for Palestinian freedom are very courageous progressives. It requires a lot of courage to take on that fight. So they tend to also be the people who fight the most courageously on a whole range of issues that are often difficult politically. Whereas whether it's, you know, on abortion, on environment, on other economic issues, whereas the kind of milquetoast moderate kind of people that you get in return after them, like when they're defeated, like George Latimer, who are kind of the kind of Democrats that we would have once associated with the Democratic Leadership Council, for those people who are old enough to remember that, in the Clinton era, basically very pro-corporate Democrats, they're not going to be people who are going to be reliable champions on any of the progressive issues, even if they have a D next to their name. And I think that's a point that we have to make to people.
Well, particularly as AIPAC acts as a kind of filter, where if you're too progressive on almost any issue, you're on their radar. And, you know, unless Israel-Palestine is the only issue you're not progressive on, mm-hmm. You know, you're going to be a target.
Yeah, and what we've seen in some races in the cycles is that actually groups that are not actually Israel-focused, but are basically just want moderate pro-corporate Democrats, even like weird people like cryptocurrency folks, will often go in alongside AIPAC and the Democratic Majority for Israel, because in a way it's a signal. If pro-Palestinian, then you kind of know from a corporate perspective they're potentially going to be a bit of a danger for you in general.
Yes, but I suppose what I see with dismay is that while our opponents are very good at forming alliances and not subjecting people to litmus tests before they're willing to accept their support, right, we don't do that so much on the left.
I think that's true. I think that's true. And I think especially this is an era, this is obviously a moment since October 7th and since the war in Gaza, on this issue, it's a moment of tremendous anger and also radicalization. And it's also one of the weird difficulties about the pro-Palestine movement, the movement for Palestinian freedom, is it doesn't have a political entity speaking for the Palestinians that can offer a coherent message, which is also, I think, contributes to this disunity. I mean, when you think about the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s, they weren't just taking their agenda of boycotts from the ANC. The ANC had laid out a vision of what they wanted, right? They had written, the Freedom Charter was written in 1954. And so in some ways, you had a political vision that people could rally around, whereas neither Mahmoud Abbas's Palestinian Authority nor Hamas is offering a political agenda that I think most people can rally around. And I think that also produces this division, this schism, this lack of ideological coherence.
Is that also reflected in the U.S. in terms of, you know, this sort of shifting coalitions? I mean, one of the things I noticed at Bowman's rally on Saturday was you know, the noisy, if not terribly numerous, contingent from within our lifetime, whose line was basically, we're not going to defend AOC or Bernie or Bowman because, you know, they've endorsed Joe Biden. So forget it. We should be working to get rid of all these people.
Right. I mean, this is not a new thing on the left, a kind of purity politics that just doesn't engage with the political realities that exist, I think it's unfortunate because that energy could be much, much better spent, and it's counterproductive to be protesting AOC or Jamal Bowman, who are in the top 2% of members of Congress in terms of their support for Palestinian rights, when you should be focusing on protesting other people. And also, you know, politicians are politicians. They're not going to be able to live up to a kind of standard of moral purity in politics. If they were, they wouldn't get into politics in the first place. Politics is about compromise. So you want to push people as much as you can, but you also want to recognize that they do face their own political realities, and it doesn't do you any good, you know, if they're not in office anymore.
How salient was the money in this race?
The money clearly played a really important role. It's hard to quantify how much it compared to redistricting and how much compared to some of Bowman's political deficiencies. But I think that it's fair to say that if George Latimer had not known that he would have gotten this amount of money, he may not have entered the race in the first place. And so Jamal Bowman would have had a weaker opponent. And that if there had not been this amount of money, that at the very least, it would have been a much closer race. And perhaps, in fact, Jamal Bowman would have won.
Okay, Peter, that was all fabulous. Thanks so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it.